Our final presenter is Jesse Fain. Jesse is a PhD student in ethnomusicology at York University in Toronto, and he's done research on black gospel in the Toronto area and is moving now into the wider province of Ontario. But today he's actually going to present on white gospel and the influence of the internet once we figure out some technical things. Are we ready to go? All right.
Yeah.
Jesse.
Okay. Oh.
Thank you, and good afternoon. I'm excited to be with you today to share with you a three-part presentation which arose out of my research on Southern gospel music. First, I will share some useful online resources and research techniques that I have used to discover rare recordings and discographies relating to Southern gospel music. Second, I will discuss the role of libraries and sound archives in the midst of these online resources, and I will recommend some possible institutional responses. Third, I will discuss how my techniques and suggestions might be applied in light of copyright law and notions of ethics surrounding the use of intellectual property. Let me begin by saying that Southern gospel music, that is, white gospel music with links to the rural South, has been grossly under-researched in spite of its cultural and musical importance. This apparent lack of interest in Southern gospel is seen not only in the academic community, but also in the music industry, as record labels have made little or no effort to re-release early Southern gospel music recordings. Thus, in my own research of Southern gospel music, I found it necessary to rely on various audio and video sharing sites to find recordings of key artists. In this regard, I have had far more success relying on informal channels of music dissemination via the internet than on the established infrastructure of music stores, online retailers, and libraries. Furthermore, unpublished online discographies have been useful for discovering release dates and catalog numbers of key Southern gospel music recordings. Information on such recordings was not available anywhere else. Allow me to show how I used internet resources to discover recordings by three key Southern gospel artists: Smith's Sacred Singers, the Vaughan Recording Quartet, and the Homeland Harmony Quartet. At a time when most Southern gospel groups could not make a living or gain popularity without the support of a Shapenote songbook publishing company, Smith's Sacred Singers from Georgia became tremendously successful and well-known through record sales alone. Led by Frank Smith, the group was discovered in 1926 by Frank Walker, an A&R man and talent scout for Columbia Records. The first record featured the songs Pictures from Life's Other Side and Where We'll Never Grow Old. The release was immediately and incredibly successful, selling 277,000 copies within a few months, making it one of Columbia's best-selling old-time recordings. According to Charles Wolfe, quote, Smith went on to record a total of 66 songs for Columbia between 1926 and 1930, more than any other single gospel group in that time recorded for any company, end quote. Smith's Sacred Singers are tremendously important because the group's early success proved that there was a market for Southern gospel music, and soon every major label was recording gospel artists. In spite of the obvious cultural significance and early commercial success of this group, no original recordings by Smith's Sacred Singers have been re-released. However, if you direct your attention to the screen, a simple keyword search for Smith's Sacred Singers on YouTube.com produces links to the earliest recordings of the group. You'll see that the first two results there are Where We'll Never Grow Old and Pictures from Life's Other Side. YouTube also proved to be a valuable resource for finding recordings by groups associated with the James D. Vaughan Music Company. James D. Vaughan was arguably the most significant figure in Southern gospel music history up to World War II. Probably his most important and influential innovation was his decision in 1910 to sponsor a traveling quartet to attend and perform at singing conventions in order to promote and sell his songbooks. It was such a successful endeavor that soon there were several quartets sponsored by the Vaughan Company. By the late 20s, there were as many as 16 quartets traveling and performing as a Vaughan Quartet and selling Vaughan publications. Quartet sponsorship was eventually practiced by virtually every other songbook publishing company. Thus, Vaughan's successful sponsorship of quartets marks the beginning of what would gradually develop into the Southern gospel music industry. In spite of the importance and prominence of the Vaughan Company up to World War II, and in spite of the many recordings released by various Vaughan ensembles, to my knowledge, there was only one recording available on compact disc by a quartet associated with the Vaughan Company. James R. Goff Jr. included the song I'll Not Deny My Savior by the Vaughan Sand Mountain Quartet in a compilation CD that accompanies his excellent book entitled Close Harmony, A History of Southern Gospel. In order to hear other recordings by Vaughan quartets, it was necessary for me to consult YouTube. And as you can see by this link, a simple keyword search for Vaughan Quartet yielded some favorable results. You will notice links to the song Master of the Storm. It's in small letters down here. And this was one of the earliest recordings by the Vaughan Recording Quartet released through Victor Records in 1928. The Master of the Storm not only demonstrates YouTube's value as a resource for finding rare recordings, it also points to the supportive and helpful YouTube community. In the comments section of the video page, one YouTube user asked the uploader for a release date. The uploader quickly responded by writing in the comment section that, according to his research, the catalog number is Victor 21756 and that the song was recorded in 1928. I was able to verify the accuracy of this information by performing a Google search of Victor 21756 using quotations. And as you can see from this page, doing so yields multiple discographies that associate Victor 21756 with the Master of the Storm. And by clicking on the first link labeled dovesong.com, we are taken to this page. And as you can see, we have a useful photograph there and a discography of several recordings by Vaughan quartets and Vaughan ensembles. The last Southern Gospel recording I wish to discuss today is Gospel Boogie by the Homeland Harmony Quartet. Originally named Everybody's Gonna Have a Wonderful Time Up There, this song was released in early 1948 with a small newly formed label called White Church Records. The record sold an amazing 200,000 copies, making the Homeland Harmony Quartet the first white Southern Gospel quartet to have a nationally popular best-selling record. The song quickly became known simply as Gospel Boogie due to Leroy Abernathy's controversial jazz-infused piano accompaniment. Gospel Boogie represents an important shift in Southern gospel music towards the mainstream entertainment industry and away from reliance on publishing companies, singing conventions, and church appearances. This song is not available on compact disc in spite of its cultural importance and commercial success. Unfortunately, it is not available on YouTube either. However, as you can see, by performing a simple Google search of Homeland Harmony Quartet Gospel Boogie, we are shown several results of MP3 sharing sites that host or index this song. One of them is called mp3gangster.com, and clicking on that link takes us to this page where, as you can see, the file is available to play as a streaming MP3, or it is available for download. Looking at this page, you'll also notice that there are nearly 1.5 million MP3 files available for download from this site by over 350,000 artists. And of course, this site is only one of many different MP3 sharing sites that are online. And so suffice it to say that these informal online channels of music dissemination offer access to a wealth of sound recordings that would be nearly impossible to acquire through any other means. Lack of discographical information is one problem associated with acquiring music through informal channels online. However, there are a number of techniques and resources that can be used to discover release dates, catalog numbers, and other useful information. I already mentioned an example of how YouTube users sometimes post discographical information in the description or comment sections of the video webpage. I've also found that eBay.com can be used to discover discographical information. A keyword search for a given artist or album usually yields a list of relevant vinyl, cassette tapes, and compact discs for sale. Often users will include detailed discographical information on the recording being sold. User-submitted photos of the recording can sometimes be useful as well. Discographical information found using YouTube and eBay can be verified by performing a Google search of the record label and catalog number using quotations, as I demonstrated earlier. One can also consult an online discography. Probably one of the most valuable online discographies is the Both Sides Now album discography at bsnpubs.com, which I have pictured here. And scrolling down here is just kind of a description of what they've all done. And it has received a Britannica Internet Guide Award for excellence in, quote, quality, accuracy of content, presentation, and usability, end quote. Users can either use this site by doing a keyword search, which is pictured here, or they can browse the list of hundreds of different record labels, and then from there click on a specific label, and there's a list of that label's catalog. There's also a number of useful histories of labels, which are pictured here. And just to give you an idea of how much information is available on this site, here's a list of labels that start with letters A through C. And if I can scroll down here, we have A&M. There's lots of different labels and also subsidiary labels. So these are just the ones that start with the letter A. And it goes on. It's important to note that the Both Sides Now has limited its catalog to LPs. For other formats, the online 78 RPM discographical project at 78discography.com is useful. And I have that pictured here. And similarly, if we scroll down, we see that there's quite a long list of different record labels that they've cataloged here. There's Columbia. In light of the resources and conveniences offered by the internet with regard to rare recordings and discographies, what can we say about the role of sound libraries and archives? The internet is obviously capable of offering infinitely more recordings than any single physical library or archive can store. Furthermore, acquiring recordings using the internet in the comfort of one's own home is far easier and faster than traveling to a sound library or archive to search for recordings. Has the internet caused sound libraries and archives to become unnecessary and obsolete? I would suggest that there is still a great need for sound libraries and archives, but perhaps some upgrades would strengthen the relevancy and visibility of these institutions in an increasingly digital age. The most significant advantage that libraries and archives have over the internet is access to original physical recordings. In spite of the conveniences offered by MP3 technology, digital media does not encapsulate the experience of seeing, handling, and listening to an original vinyl disc. Furthermore, the valuable discographic and iconographic information housed on album covers, liner notes, and vinyl discs seems to get lost during the digitization process. I have found that reissues on compact disc are useful in this regard as well. Liner notes often contain substantial histories, discographies, and photographs not available anywhere else. Finally, let us not take for granted the simple and obvious fact that an MP3 version of previously released material is merely a digital copy of an original disc, tape, or cylinder recording. In the same way that art galleries house and guard original paintings, so too should libraries and archives continue to house and guard original formats of recordings. Given the music industry's prioritization of profit over preservation, and given the growth of digital media, the role of libraries and archives in the preservation of original physical recordings is crucial. That being said, I feel that libraries and archives should also embrace digital technology in a variety of ways. First, libraries and archives should have a stronger online presence. Why is it that when I perform a Google search of a rare recording, digital MP3 libraries are found instead of physical libraries? A stronger presence on Google and social networking sites would increase awareness of sound libraries and archives. Second, there should be more detailed information made available online about the recordings in the catalogs of sound libraries and archives. All discographical details about every recording in the catalog should be accessible and keyword searchable online. Photographs of album covers, liner notes, and discs should also be included. Third, sound libraries and archives should digitize their collections. Storing sound recordings as MP3s and hard drives is cost-effective, reliable, and occupies a relatively small amount of physical space. Digitizing collections would not only serve to back up valuable sound recordings, the MP3s could potentially allow for easier access to the recordings. Perhaps patrons could listen to MP3s of recordings from the library's collection as streaming audio in the library or even online. Fourth, libraries and archives should supplement their physical collections by acquiring MP3s using the means I discussed earlier. If an MP3 copy of a song is available online, and if it is impossible to acquire a physical recording of the song, libraries should add such an MP3 to a digital collection that could be accessed by patrons in the library or perhaps online. Such digital collections could also be shared with other sound libraries. Perhaps an online interlibrary sound database could be created. Following these and other initiatives would enable library websites to become useful online resources in and of themselves, instead of mere navigators of physical collections. I am well aware that my advocacy for the use of informal online channels of music dissemination and my suggestions to sound libraries and archives may challenge interpretations of copyright law and notions of ethics surrounding the use of intellectual property. Allow me to share some thoughts on how we might ethically apply my techniques and suggestions. Individual researchers and institutions should make every effort to acquire recordings in ways that respect the rights of music creators and support artists by purchasing compact discs or legal MP3s. However, when record companies do not reissue vinyl releases on compact discs, we do not have the opportunity to support the artists, authors, or record labels. We are faced with two options of acquiring such recordings: purchase used vinyl recordings, or use informal online channels of music dissemination, such as those previously discussed. The first option is a more established mode of exchange, while the second may seem controversial in light of various copyright issues that have plagued a number of internet resources throughout the past decade. However, the artists are not being supported when we pursue either of these two options of acquiring recordings. Furthermore, the recordings may be in public domain. If not, the use of these recordings in this situation for research and educational purposes may fall under the Fair Use or Fair Dealings Clause of copyright law. In summary, I feel that my methods and suggestions should only be applied in research and educational contexts to recordings that have not been reissued on compact disc. Some of my recommendations to sound libraries and archives may still be difficult to apply legally, especially my idea of allowing patrons to access digital collections as streaming audio online. Perhaps agreements with record labels could be reached that would allow online access to recordings. Let me conclude by saying that I hope that the online resources and techniques I have shared prove to be useful to other researchers. I have applied these methods to Southern gospel music, but I imagine they could be applied to many other forms of music as well. I also hope that at least some of my recommendations to sound libraries and archives will be put into place, if at all possible. Libraries should strengthen their visibility and relevance by finding ways to make their websites useful resources that not only navigate, but also reflect physical collections. Posting discographical information, photographs, or streaming MP3s would accomplish this goal. Finally, I hope that my comments surrounding the ethical and legal applications of my techniques and suggestions will serve as a springboard for further discussion during the question period that follows. And I'd especially be interested in hearing some people to my left who are involved with the UCLA Ethnomusicology Archive. Perhaps some of these things are already being practiced, and they'd be able to comment on how these things might be executed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jesse. We have a few minutes for questions and answers, or just questions.
Sure. Yes.
We don't promise any answers.
I wholeheartedly agree with your assessment of the use of the internet for locating rare recordings that are otherwise unattainable. mm-hmm. information system. Mm-hmm. The ephemeral nature of the web is not something you can always depend on. You might have found a YouTube audio clip of that rare Southern Gospel recording, but there's no guarantee that that person who posted it won't end their subscription to YouTube and won't be off the web tomorrow.
That's right.
So,
right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. A commonly used software program to capture streaming audio, probably maybe one of the most common, is just called FreeCorder, and it's just free and it kind of sits in your browser. And there's also a number of browser plugins that you can download. So if you go to a page and then you can click a little button, and you can even on YouTube, you can either save things as a video file, or you can just save the sound of the video file as an MP3 file, and that's what I've done, and that's what you could do, because as you've said, YouTube is certainly unreliable. It changes all the time. Sometimes people take their stuff off, and so, yeah, thank you for that.
I think Brigida has a comment.
Yes, please.
The site you showed, the one that got the Britannica notification, I actually used that site. It's pretty good, and the guys who set it up are very thorough. Mm-hmm. Another thing you could do as a young scholar is to actually contact people of those kind of sites, because they will email you back. When I was researching a particular artist, I saw that they had the imprint of the album, but I knew there was information on the back of it. And so I say, hey, you guys, is there something on the back of that album telling me some information? And they respond back, so that would actually help. And his suggestions were definitely PDF everything you find when you find it, because it changes. And I think YouTube's, as it becomes more commercial and Vivo's involved and there's more money to be made from it, it's when a particular genre gets popular, like if Southern Gospel takes off tomorrow and people realize that all those old Columbia and records are online, they often get yanked. That's happened with a couple of genres. Or in some cases, if a user puts up too much old gospel or some old video of gospel, he doesn't have the rights, they will cancel that person's account. So if you see it and you can get it, get it. But definitely try to contact the person who has it, because oftentimes these are sometimes TV producers or people who worked on shows, like those independent regional shows, and they just have the Betamax tapes at their house. And so sometimes they might can actually send you the copies of them so you can have your own high-quality copy that's actually better than YouTube in some cases to get that. But as far as archives, it's also tricky, particularly with mm-hmm. field recordings, because in the Gala Project, when I was talking with John, because he's a trained archivist, and I'm like a field work person, and I'm more of an ethnographer, budding ethnographer. When we were dealing with the recordings that we got from HMF, they also record their own events. A lot of black churches now, they record services on audio or video, and they sell them after church services to their members. And so while they're not officially commercial recordings by a company, they are commercially available. And so a lot of the archive holdings that we had from them were their own tapes of themselves. And because they sold them, we had to categorize them as commercial recordings, even though you can't go on Amazon and get them. And so that kind of information is kind of fuzzy in archives dealing with how they label things. Mm-hmm. And so when you would go in there, you couldn't automatically discount a holding as, oh, that's a commercial record I can find from a company. Mm-hmm. A lot of the commercial recordings they had been saving were by regional gospel record labels in LA who weren't bought by a major conglomerate. And so if you don't get it in that archive copy, it's not existing anywhere else and won't be redistributed or re-released on the Greatest Hits Project. So a lot of times these archive findings, trying to find the original source, who owns the physical copy, mm-hmm. sometimes it's very, very helpful. And it's hard for archivists, because when you want to stream it, you can't find who owns the rights. It's just out there. It's either someone who had a recording studio in the garage and is no longer existing, or you know, you might know someone's granddaughter. So it's kind of up in the air with that.
Yeah. We have time for one more comment from Tony.
It's good that you ask those questions about what archives are doing. You should know it's just as frustrating to run an archive presence, like an archive that has a collection, is the last place that can take a chance with copyright law, because they can be sued. The University of California can be sued for misuse in a way that people who run a website out of another country can't be.
Right.
So it makes archives particularly frustrating to work in, and yet we have tremendous resources. I would look, however, as you were sort of saying, you can't get at them, I would look at the Morrill University of Newfoundland, which has put a huge collection online. I would suggest you look at the University of the National Library and the British Library, which has special permissions so that you can actually use collections if you're using them within the United Kingdom, but you can't get access to them if you're outside, and also other sorts of things. Archives are actually working with this, and I think you should probably, in addition to criticizing, we should probably look, I suggest, at the ones that are actually succeeding, mention that those might be models that we follow.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. I didn't know Memorial was doing that. And I think that one of the things that I had said is, you know, if there's places like Memorial and that place in Britain that you mentioned, I feel they should somehow, and I'm not a computer person, I'm not, you know, big expert, but they should somehow have an increased presence on Google. Like, you know, if, that's sort of the next, that would be sort of the next step, you know.
And I'll quickly add to that list before we close the Frontera Collection Project at UCLA, which Chris Trackwitz is very much involved with, which does something very similar to what you're talking about with White Gospel, only with early Mexican and Mexican-American recordings of the same era on 78 from some of the major labels like Columbia, but also smaller labels that no longer exist. And so libraries are taking risks and chances with this, and as much as they can, but again, the bigger the institution, the bigger the target we have on our backs, so we really can't do things that individuals can. Yeah. I'd like to thank you all for coming, and thank you to our presenters.
and
yes, come get a balloon if you didn't get one. Happy 50th birthday. Have a good lunch.